I'm Josh Cooperman, and this is Convo by Design. When I first started the podcast, a long time ago, it all started as an experience. I love design and architecture. I always have. I recently realized that if I had taken the time spent doing the show and instead went back to school, I could have become an architect by now. I say that tongue firmly planted in cheek, not because I wouldn't love to be an architect, designer, or set decorator, but because had I done that, I wouldn't be able to do this. And this is what I truly love to do. I find extraordinary joy in speaking with the creatives whom I admire, exploring their journeys, telling their stories, and sharing them with you. So that's why this is really special for me, this episode this week. Joining me on the podcast today is Matthew Cheney and Bryn Garrett with EYRC Architects. To be completely frank with you, there are a few firms of which I feel like an honorary member, and EYRC is one of them. I have spoken and shared time with Takashi and I, FAIA, over the years. He's the Y in EYRC. I spent an amazing afternoon with Stephen Ehrlich, FAIA, the E, while in Palm Springs covering the Ridge Mountain project during Modernism Week in, I think 2017, maybe? I have recorded virtually with them. I've recorded live from their offices in Los Angeles, live from Rancho Mirage at that project house. I feel very close to this firm. It's only a matter of time before we hear from the R, which is Patricia Ree, FAIA, and it's coming. But today, we have the C, Matthew Cheney, as well as Bryn Garrett, both partners in EYRC Architects. Bryn, most recently, could be heard on a West Edge Wednesday episode of Convo by Design from his participation on a panel at the West Edge Design Fair about the current state of residential architecture. Matthew and Bryn join me on the show to talk about a number of things architecture and design related, and I am absolutely thrilled to share this conversation with you. I am so proud of my partnership with Thermasol. They have been presenting partners of Convo by Design for 4+ years, and there is a certain amount of pride that comes with saying that the show is presented by the company that is the absolute best in the world at what they do. Thermasol engineers the most exceptional smart shower products and steam shower systems worldwide for a few reasons. They were the first company to design and patent the technology here in the U.S. dating back to 1958. Thermasol, a U.S.-based manufacturer in Round Rock, Texas, employs an engineering team that designs, tests, and continuously refines the product. Their quality control team tests every single steam generator before it departs the factory. Who else does that? Nobody. I have the pleasure of working with some world-class designers and architects who tell me, and you know this, that the idea of luxury has changed, especially when clients want a spa-like bathroom. Steam is mandatory, or it's just not considered luxury. If you want to add steam, you have really one true option if you want the best, and that's Thermasol. Mitch Altman, third-generation CEO of this family-owned company of 65 years, continues to innovate the bathroom and shower space through technological marvels such as intelligent showering systems, sound therapy, aromatherapy, chromotherapy, technical interfaces, and so much more. And now, Thermasol, the industry leader in steam bath equipment and technology since 1958, is enhancing its already stellar family of products with the new indoor and outdoor luxury saunas. Available in 3 design configurations, each sauna is handcrafted from clear Western red cedar or Nordic spruce, inspired by the brilliance of Northern European sauna technology and design. Thermasol's latest collections offer luxurious features, and there's only one option if you want the finest experience, Thermasol. Check out Thermasol.com and at Thermasol on the
It's so funny because I'm following a train of thought. Bryn, what panel were you on?
I was on the Next in Residential Design.
That's right. So yeah. It's so funny because it's funny. So I saw, Matthew, I saw Bryn at the West Edge Design Fair.
Yes.
where I produce all of the programming. And so I've been editing and going through all of the content, and it's perfect, Bryn, because that one, while you guys moderated by Duan Tran, correct? Yeah. Uh-huh. So while you guys were talking about that, it was like, yeah, the whole nature of residential architecture has had to change the manner in which you think about it, because the nature of residential architecture has changed so dramatically post-pandemic. And it's funny, because while I hate talking about the pandemic anymore, the ramifications of it, it's like the pandemic in 1921, you know, people still use subway tile in their homes. And, you know, that was kind of something that came out of that. How has this changed? You know, you've got Matthew, you've got banging in the background, construction going. It's just part of life and part of what we do, but it had to have changed the manner in which you think about the business. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think every perspective of every sector that we're involved in, it's sort of changed the thinking, not just on, you know, our part, but on our clients' part, especially like what their needs are, have shifted. I mean, the obvious thing is, oh, I need a quiet space in my home to work from now, or to run my podcast out of, or, you know, like every environment is now inherently a hybrid environment, trying to do multiple things. Every office is trying to be less of an office and more of a, you know, a community space and more of a, you know, gathering space, more home-like. Every home is trying to be more office-like. Like everything's sort of combined in interesting ways that are, you know, are unique frequently to the individuals and the organizations that are in them. So, you know, it's always about tailoring. It's just, you know, it's the need for a new suit now.
Bryn?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say most of our clients and the users in our projects have a heightened sense of kind of that stark contrast in their day-to-day lives, where there may be the creature comforts that they've now become used to at home over the pandemic, and then they still have to go into a busy kind of office environment, maybe a couple days a week. And so I think, like Matthew was saying, it's not just affect the residential market, it's affected all of our markets. And so the office environment may... the design of that space may adopt more creature comforts or things that we are used to at home that we've become used to over the last couple of years. So in that respect, you know, in the beginning kind of schematic conceptual design phases, clients are coming to us and they're kind of sharing those experiences that they've had over the pandemic living at home and what they're hoping to kind of see and how they're hoping to see that improve their own projects. And so I think we're going to see that for, you know, at least a decade, and it'll probably bleed on before long after that.
You know, what's really interesting is I have a fondness for EYRC. I have an affinity for your firm because, you know, when I started Convo by Design in 2013, one of my first guests was Takashi. Takashi has always, he's one of those people. There are some people that I have had the good fortune of working with: Bridget Calder Cheadle, Takashi, Cliff Fong, some people who, you know, whenever I ask, they're like, yeah, absolutely, I can do that. He's kind of like a total yes person. And I had the benefit. So Takashi and I have had multiple conversations. Stephen and I, the last time Stephen and I spoke was at Ridge Mountain in Rancho Mirage, where we actually shot from there during Modernism Week 1 year. I want to say it was maybe 2017 or 2016. So it was early on.
Yeah.
One of the things that I love, and when I come to LA, fly into LAX and then head over to West Hollywood, is I always pass by the building, by your offices. And that's where I first interviewed Takashi from. There's a vibe that sort of emotes out of the firm. We haven't even started talking about the work yet, but I'm just curious because I talk to so many designers and so many architects, and sometimes the offices are a little, it reminds me of a conversation I had once with Bunny Williams, who when working for Sister Parish and Albert Hadley, learned early on that knowing what you don't want in a firm is as important as knowing what you want. how the vibe that you guys have, that had to have, is that something that you work on daily? Does it come automatically, or is it just kind of a result of working? You know, you find like-minded individuals. Your projects are all different, and you're not the same designers, mm-hmm. but the vibe seems consistent. Matthew, where did that come from?
Yeah, I think, you know, I guess I've joined Steven in 2001. So what are we at 22 years at this point? Our relationship can drink, which is nice. There's always like, and I think honestly, this is like the personality of Steven that has leached into the water that we have all, you know, sort of grown in. So it's in the collective DNA at this point. And it really is I think it's like rooted in inclusivity. He's not, you know, as talented as he is and as, you know, accomplished as he is, you know, in the early parts of his career before we all joined, he has always operated by a philosophy of kind of inclusion and bringing, it's a very big tent and there's room for not just many voices, but almost all voices of the firm. And I think just as a result of that, you get this diversity of ideas. There is no, there's a real effort not to have kind of any preconceptions about what a solution, you know, should be necessarily. But there are definitely common values in there, you know, around, you know, material honesty and structural honesty and like sort of this elevated practicality, a sense of how things are, you know, actually going to be built and who's going to build them and how do we kind of take advantage of those inherent, you know, talents that are the craft that is part of the architecture. And so by, you know, kind of, for lack of a better word, weaving all of those kind of things together on every project, you wind up with, you know, this, you know, sort of consistent stone soup, you know, if you will, is always just sort of integrating different ideas, really listening to the client, listening to the place, the values that you're trying to imbue in there. But that the hand of the weaver, you know, ultimately does, you know, if looked at, you know, over the cross of, you know, the over hundreds of tapestries, you can, while everyone's different, you can tell that the same hand is there. And I think it actually makes it a very special place to work and a special way to work even. We have, you know, so many of our, you know, great employees that we have are, you know, tell us all the time that this is just unlike anywhere else that they've worked. And we're quite proud of that.
Yeah, it's a great vibe. And Bryn, what is the idea behind? I'm going to ask about the multicultural modernism and the idea behind it. But also, it's really interesting to me because to Matthew's point, you know, I kind of feel like well-developed organizations tend to attract like-minded individuals who kind of join. It's always an interesting idea for me where you have all of these individuals. It's like an individual sport within a team concept. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want to have every architect within a firm who all think the same way and design the same way. But at the same time, taking those individual differences and the finer nuances of their skill and talent and ideas and what they do and making consistent with the overall idea and ethos, morals, and values of a firm. Bryn, talk to me about this multicultural modernism approach.
Yeah, multicultural modernism, I mean, it was really a term that Steven coined at the beginning of the practice, and it's carried through. We maybe use that term less today in describing a lot of our projects, but the values and the intent was very clear from the beginning. And I think Steven was trying to establish a diverse group of designers, but that we shared certain values, I think, and that's the vibe that maybe you're picking up on, or that we hopefully exude, is this sense of empathy. I think, you know, joining the practice 12 years ago, I immediately saw kind of Steven in a room with a client and the empathy that he showed towards that client. I think that attracted a lot of the designers now that we have that have that same sense of empathy. But then beyond that, as we get into the design process, everyone's free to kind of explore their own ideas or their own backgrounds. And that's where we often say that the great idea or the conception of a project could come from anyone in the design team. There's not a big ego in the room that's passing down a sketch to be executed. This is really a collaborative effort, and I think the multicultural modernism, although it often was used to describe kind of maybe our process or work, it's the diversity of our clients, but it's also the diversity of our staff and the different viewpoints that they bring to the design process.
Yeah, so I mean, it's interesting. No, sorry, please go ahead.
I was going to add to that just a smidge. Also, just the this kind of like anthropological process of mining the clients, the project, everything sort of about it, you know, for its sort of in inherent meanings and values, and figuring out how to make that legible in the work.
And here's why I find that so interesting. You know, I have said many times, my background is not in design or architecture, it's in broadcasting. And, you know, as the director of motorsports for CBS in Dallas, I've always been fascinated with the idea of the individual sport in a team concept. And I don't think it's really looked at enough in our industry in particular. And I think it's why, you know, like as of this recording, the new AD100 has come out, which I have a fair amount of issues with that. And every year I just look at it and I'm like, all great creatives, but you can't tell me that 80% of the world's greatest creatives all come from New York. I can't believe that.
Right.
But that is an aside. One of the things as social media became more prevalent is our industry used to be, I want to say, much kinder than it is now. With the advent of social media, it allowed people sitting in their own homes, in the safety and security of their own homes, to throw darts and arrows at other people's work. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I do love so much about your firm, having studied it the way that I would study, you know, a NASCAR team of four drivers running in a race of 43 cars, each one's trying to win, but they're also trying to elevate their entire team. Mm-hmm. And I find that very similar to a firm such as mm-hmm. yours. You know, you have individuals who are all trying to do their best work at the same time. And you guys do it in this quiet, sophisticated way. And it's because mm-hmm. you all come from such a diverse background. You know, Matthew, what did you learn in 3 years working for Disney that has affected your career now?
Oh gosh. A lot. That was, I was fortunate. Yeah. Coming out of school, maybe I'd been out for 3 or 4 years or so and managed to land a position at Walt Disney Imagineering, and moved through the ranks there fairly quickly and eventually became production designer over the, one of the lands inside of the new California Adventure Park in Anaheim, and most notably over the ride film called Soarin' Over California. And the thing that the real takeaways from there was, one, that seniority didn't matter necessarily. I mean, there was a strong hierarchy there, but it's like, if you could do the job and had the ideas and knew how to, you know, execute, you were like, go, we need that. So it was very easy there to kind of you know, outperform, you know, your rank or title or tenure. And the other thing there was just the wild interdisciplinary nature of it, and the incredible disciplines that are almost like unique to Disney. You know, so there was, you know, I was in the show set group, which was, you know, sort of focused on the show. Which was, as it turns out, like sort of the I think was arguably the most important group there, because everything there is to support the show. But you're interacting with the architecture group, you're interacting with the ride mechanical group. There's special effects groups. There's the film group, like all of these different people that you're bringing together, that are just these wildly diverse disciplines. And how do you weave? How do you stitch them together? And so I think the thing that was really incredible there was the exposure that gave me to, you know, and I'd worked in visual effects for a couple of years prior to coming to Disney even, and just sort of realizing how that experience with visual effects and the technology kind of behind that suddenly was applicable to this, you know, developing this ride and how to interact with those different groups, with our film group, with the sound and audio, and then with the and kind of coming out of that, like, you know, as I joined, you know, Stephen and started bringing on work, we, you know, landed the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University there. And all of a sudden, all of that experience was super relevant in that environment. And I think nobody could quite figure out how this, you know, at the time, still young, rapidly slipping away, architect, you know, was familiar with all of this technology at this like sort of level. And what that sort of, the real takeaway from all of that was this kind of like fluency with systems is also important. Like it's important to, you know, it's obviously, it's important to be able to design form and, you know, space and composition and all of these other, you know, sort of pure design elements, but you also need to be in control of the systems that are the backbones of these buildings so that they are as elegant as the everything else. And, you know, modernism is the, you know, hardest discipline in the sense there's nowhere to hide. There's not a lot of crown molding and wall base and furrings and things like that to tuck things into. So anyway, so I think it was like that for me always, that experience got me deeply involved with the systems and with collaborating with the different consultants and experts and bringing everybody sort of together around an idea. Yeah, it was a really incredible experience. It's still with me today for sure.
See, and I'm fascinated by that. And it's funny because I recall experiencing that ride, I want to say when it first came out, and thinking, I don't know if it's because I'm a native Angeleno and a Californian first and foremost, mm-hmm. that made me enjoy it as much as I did, because the process of sitting there as if you are flying through this experience, the experiential nature was so different than a traditional ride. And I bring that up because it's so much more relevant now, because design and architecture has become an experiential endeavor, I would say more so than I think it's ever been before. You know, I can just sort of having walked through and done a deep dive in Neutra's VDL house in Silver Lake, you know, where you go into Dione's room and the bed is on a pivot and it shifts out so that you can make it, because the bed is so small, the room is right. So small, rather, mm-hmm. that it was almost like it was imagineered for this type of, you know, you walk up these stairs and you look outside and you've got deck after deck and window and water, and everything was thought through. And that's something that Disney is traditionally known for. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fascinating to hear you explain that, because I get it. And that's one of the things that's so important and relevant about architecture and design right now, is that it is being designed for how it's used as opposed to how it's going to look and function. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's a great way of explaining it, but then Bryn, you know, one of the things that you do is, you know, when we're talking about sustainability, mm-hmm. net zero, traditionally things that are very challenging to accomplish without, I would say, negatively affecting the design itself, because you have added constraints and restrictions, that too goes to the experience, because people have discovered over the past 10 years that wellness is an experience that they want in their homes, whereas it was so easy to go to a spa or salon. It was so easy to go to the gym. It was so easy to leave the house and go to the office and then come home and have the home just sort of be a singularly functional space instead of a multifunctional, multi-hyphenate. Mm-hmm. How has the past 5 years in doing what you do, coming in, doing this before, you know, pre-pandemic, how has that affected the nature of your work, especially from the sustainability net zero standpoint, but also from an experiential standpoint?
Hmm. Yeah, I think in terms of sustainability, you know, in the last 5-10 years, it's become a lot more about the metrics and measurable data. And it's great that we have the tools to do that now. But I think as a practice, the sustainability really started with hand in hand with multicultural modernism and that approach to looking not only at the site and the culture and the history, but the climate, the natural environment, and making it so that the home lives, you know, with the client, and they're not feeling like they're having to go elsewhere for their wellness, exercise, getting out of the home. So I think for us, sustainability is one in the same with the design. It's no longer a tack on. It's not an add on. It shouldn't be any more expensive adding sustainability or wellness to your home. And the way that we look at it now, you know, with the indoor outdoor living lifestyle that we have in a lot of our projects, it's not possible to control and mechanically ventilate people's homes all the time. And so it's really important that we rely on passive strategies and get an understanding of what the climate kind of ranges are for our clients. Are they comfortable just, you know, living through the winter in a sweater and a hot cup of tea? You know, we don't need to have the set point for the heat at 75 degrees. I think what we've also been surprised about in the last 5 years, especially with the pandemic, is people's appetite and desire to have more sustainable and resilient projects and houses. They see that there's increasing number of rolling blackouts, wildfires, have you. So they are just as interested as we are as architects in having a high performing home that will be resilient through these natural disasters that seem to be kind of, especially in California, becoming a more predominant part of our lives.
I wanted to ask you too, as a follow-up to that, both of you actually, and Bryn, I'll start with you. Well, first of all, is the firm segmented by, do you find yourselves individually siloed? Like someone works on higher education, someone works on public, you know, and municipal buildings, and someone works on residential. Do you find yourself siloed, or is it a project by project base, or is it a team concept?
It's a team concept. So a project could have a residential component. And so, you know, there's people from all across the office with different skill sets coming together. Certainly we have kind of loosely defined studios, and that's mostly to do with kind of the skill sets and the kind of scale of projects, but every project has a different component with a different scale that brings or offers opportunities for our firm to kind of bring people across the firm into one project and not and kind of bring down those silos. So I don't think we're too siloed. Yeah.
Okay, because I wanted to follow up with that. It's really interesting. Something that I've been really fascinated by because of its importance. And I mean, look, as of this recording, so we're recording this in December for a Q1 24 publication date. But yesterday, there was another shooting on a campus, and that was at UNLV.
Yeah.
There have been well over 550 mass shootings in the country this year alone. And because it's ramping up every year, we have more and more shootings. We are living in a more violent world. Mm-hmm. It is what it is. And I have always felt that because designers and architects are futurists by nature, you kind of have to be. Designers designing for, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years on a space. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, from a design standpoint, you're really looking at a refresh or a redo. Architects, you know, you're not building something that's living less than 75 years, 100 years, 150 years, whatever the, you know, Ridge Mountain, going back to that project. That project will be there when people aren't. I mean, the way that thing was built, that will be there long after people, unless they take it down for some other reason. But because you work with so many higher education, schools, municipal buildings as well, I've become fascinated lately, and I want your take on this. And Matthew, I'll start with you. And it kind of goes back to the wellness thing too. I think they're inextricably tied. Yeah. You had, you know, pre-pandemic, people were starting to focus more on air quality and water quality within mm-hmm. their homes. And then during the pandemic, it became noise pollution, as well as the others. That was kind of like the hot button, because we're all on, you know, we were talking before this, can you hear the banging outside? There's a blower outside my house, but I, you know, and you become more fixated on that. Now I kind of feel like even on the residential side, security and safety is kind of the next thing, because it affects both your wellness, the experiential nature of architecture. And I'm curious if you are looking at that on the residential side, because when you look at a school design, mm-hmm. you have to take security. You have to think about, do you think about that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, interestingly, I don't have a statistic to compare with the mass shooting one necessarily, but I think, you know, an equally, and I suspect larger, issue is in academic settings is actually self-harm. I think the suicide and attempted suicide rates at universities is shockingly high throughout the country. And I fear that it probably outstrips, you know, gun violence even. But those issues of self-harm and, you know, sort of physical security from those types of, you know, other threats are definitely something that are on the mind of our, you know, institutional clients and are definitely like sort of are increasingly baked into our designs. And so it is this tricky balance, because you started this conversation sort of with wellness, right? And I think the first thing we're trying to do is support, and this is true of every project, our residences on through our, student housing projects, through retail, through every sector, is how do we create a supportive environment, an inclusive environment, one that gives one a moment to reflect and pause and provide sort of positivity relief rather than inducing stress and claustrophobia and increases anxiety, all those sorts of things. I mean, I think one of the statistics that's always incredible is in the UC system, I think it's 25% of students freshmen arrive with a diagnosed anxiety disorder at this point. So, I mean, it really is a very stressed out human race at this point, and that student population certainly is that as well. So, the things we're doing is, yes, from a wellness perspective is like, what are the sort of amenities? How do you create, places for that repose? So like in our project that's under construction right now at UC San Diego, the theater district, living in the learning neighborhood. I mean, it's a massive, 10.5 acre site, 2000 beds of housing and academic and retail and all of this. We designed two components into the program. One is a meditation pavilion set in between two large residential towers, but it's its own very low slung environment with, a number of natural boulders coming up in it, in the middle of a bamboo garden. And then another element we have elsewhere is a little tea house that's kind of set along a creek bed and also woven into the landscape. And just kind of these like quiet moments where a student can get away and have a minute to themselves and relax, meditate if they want, or pray, or whatever their preferred mechanism is. That's how, those are the types of ways in which we're thinking to support the wellness and the mental wellness side of things. But then on the other hand, like when we're designing like rooftop balconies and that sort of thing, like we're putting the railings to 7 feet high, and trying to do that in a way that doesn't feel like, a cage. But at the same time is remove sort of spontaneity of away from the idea of self-harm. So
you are listening to my conversation with Bryn Garrett and Matthew Cheney of EYRC Architects. We'll be right back. We talk about this all the time on the show, how design professionals, like you, just don't have the time to find your favorite brands in one place with expert, knowledgeable, and non-commissioned professionals to help you specify the right product for each of your projects, non-commissioned. That means their only incentive is your satisfaction. Pacific Sales Kitchen and Home, a Best Buy company, has just that, with over 60 years of service in Southern California. Pacific Sales is your destination for exploration, advice, and inspiration. Now, You have the Pacific Sales Kitchen and Home team to help you and offer their Pro Rewards program, which is a trade program unlike any you've experienced before. Earn 3% in Best Buy e-gift cards or 2.5% in a rewards check for every qualified and delivered sale, in addition to special trade pricing, exclusive offers, access to exclusive specials, events, and more. And here's the cherry on top, access to exclusive builder trade incentives from top brands like Viking, Sub-Zero, Wolf, Thermador, and Decor, just to mention a few. Terms and conditions do apply to the Pro Rewards program and builder trade incentives. Visit a Pacific sales expert at a showroom today for full details and to learn how you can unlock additional savings and benefits. Don't miss out on the opportunity to work with the very best of the best. Visit Pacific Sales Kitchen and Home today and elevate your projects to new heights. Pacific Sales Kitchen and Home, where excellence meets expertise.
Man, I love this. I have a new sponsor partner on the show that I want to introduce you to if you're not already familiar with them. If you are a specifying designer, architect, landscape architect, or savvy design enthusiast, if you have heard about the quiet luxury movement, this idea of crafting a lifestyle around understated elegance, simplicity, and sophistication, there's more to it than that. And I will add uncomplicated living. Isn't that what we all strive for? I am extremely happy. I'm really thrilled to share a company that embodies all of this, utilizing proprietary technology and a focus on sustainability in their stunningly beautiful products. It's TimberTech. TimberTech is the premium decking company delivering multi-tonal color blending and natural wood textures in a product that is virtually indistinguishable from a natural wood product. What does this mean? It means it's everything wood should be, a beautiful look that blends seamlessly with a well-designed space, providing years of enjoyment and performs the way you want it to. No splintering, fading, peeling, cracking, or rotting. I had a wood deck at our Manhattan Beach home, and I gotta tell you, it was exasperating every year doing the random board flip, taking out nails, resetting them, restaining them. It was a complete pain. It was complicated, and I didn't look forward to it. I wish I had TimberTech, because TimberTech is not only uncomplicated, it's beautiful. It comes in over 20 finish options and 9 collections, and 85% of the material is recycled. This is premium decking for your next project. Learn more and specify it for your next design project, TimberTech, on the socials or timbertech.com, where you can find a retailer near you, as well as a number of tools to create, design, order samples, and get the expert help you may need. TimberTech is uncomplicated luxury and performs. It's your choice for your next deck project.
In thinking through that, you know, I would venture to guess, you know, I have kids in college, and I would venture to guess that everyone who has a child in college these days, within the past few years or currently, has experienced a story mm-hmm. about fellow students committing self-harm. Yeah. So to your point, I totally get it. I think there's a difference between self-harm and harming others, both tragic. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
But, you know, it's kind of like where my kids went to elementary school. When they started elementary school, there was not a perimeter fence. Mm-hmm. Now there's a perimeter fence. I don't know of many schools that don't have perimeter fencing anymore. Sure. because you have to. And to your point, it's one of those things where you said that doesn't look like a cage. Mm-hmm. And that goes back kind of to the wellness aspect of it, because nobody wants to live in a cage. At the same time, you know, and that's why I really do love these conversations. I'll give you two examples of why I think it's so important. And I don't think there's an evaluation process in the public eye as much as, you know, there used to be architecture critics back mm-hmm. in the day, right? Back yeah. to the days of
you know, Atlas Shrugged. So you've got that whole idea of a critic could ruin the life of an architect, but mm-hmm. you've got, here's two examples. And I'd love your takes on these. And this is, we're just kind of freewheeling here a little bit. I recently had the opportunity to tour the Price Tower in Bartlesville, mm-hmm. Oklahoma, which mm-hmm. is, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright's one and only skyscraper. And yeah. in Mr. Price's office on the 19th or 20th floor of the building, you're walking in, the building seems to get narrower and narrower the higher you go. In his office, mm-hmm. he had just off the side of his office, there's a spot for his assistant. Now, this is the 1950s when mm-hmm. this is built. Gorgeous views, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright and his love of glass.
Yeah.
These views all over. So where his assistant would sit, she would look over her left shoulder and have a sight line to Mr. Price. Brilliant. Bless you. She would look over to the right where there should be a window, but Wright built it's beautiful wood, but he basically built something to keep her from being able to look out the window so that she could stay focused on her typing.
Yes.
And I'm like, that is just not cool. Like, I get it, but there's no other reason
yeah.
for that to be here. That was specifically put there. And, you know, nowadays someone will be like, well, that's, you know, you can't do that. That's just, you just can't do it. The other example, and I want your take on both of these, was, and we just lost Charlie Munger. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you guys remember this, but he had an idea. He was an amateur architect, and he had this idea for a dorm at UCSB. I bet you guys even study this.
Everywhere, yeah.
Right? Yeah. So, I mean, dick move, like not cool. Like, don't,
right,
you
yeah.
know, why in the world would you have this beautiful exterior where it could enhance the wellness of someone's life just by looking outside at the ocean, but instead making all of the windows interior and none exterior, so you can't do that?
Mm-hmm.
It's all in the way you think about it, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, certainly, you know, the Munger Hall, and to my understanding, there is a Munger Hall that was built, I think, at MIT. Like, that exists already from years ago.
In that same idea?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I need to research that. I was told by a colleague that went to the school where it is that she was like, oh, no, it's there. But and it was proliferating. That was this whole thing. Like, if you take my money, you're going to take my design and this philosophy, which is, you know, look, I mean, it's an interesting one. It is trying to solve an intractable problem of how do you drive down the cost of housing students. And even it got into a socialization model, which is like your room should not be where you want to spend time. You should want to be out in the common environments that have actual windows and everything else. So your room is where you sleep, and that's it. Do everything else outside. You're basically getting a sleeping chamber with this, and which is flipping on its head the perspective that my room is my sanctuary, and I can decorate it, and it's somewhere I do want to be. Mm. So one has to sort of buy into that philosophical shift before that starts to make sense. And, not to utterly defend it, but it's like, I do like radical ideas. And I do think that's what, to solve some of our problems, it is going to take that sort of, radical thinking. Clearly that's a bridge too far at this, moment in time for most folks to stomach. But I don't know if you've ever been on a cruise, the cheapest cabins are the ones that are internal and don't have windows. They probably sell out first, but I don't know.
Josh, with those two examples, and especially with the Price Tower, Frank Lloyd Wright, I mean, we know mm-hmm. it was during a time when the architect was kind of given the reins of the entire project. They saw the whole vision. They saw the furnishings. They saw the window treatments. They did the landscaping. I think as a practice, and we've always enjoyed more the back and forth dialogue and engagement with our clients and how we get inspired by them. So while we do practice a very modern style of architecture, you can see the kind of breadth and diversity across our portfolio, especially even in the houses, because it's distilling down an individual or a couple or a family based on their values and their history. And so we wouldn't even think today to kind of go in and try and socially engineer someone's work desk so they can't enjoy the view. I think we really there's a long design process, and it's a lot of back and forth. It's not us going and going into our little shell and doing our design and coming back and presenting a comprehensive vision for the client to just kind of accept and be a patron of. So yeah, I think it's a very different approach to of what the role of the architect and kind of that level of control and social engineering. Mm-hmm.
Along those lines, so social engineering, but also physical engineering. You know, I one of the things, you guys have one of the better architect websites, because one of the, you know, I, as a journalist, like mm-hmm. I love doing research. I really do enjoy the process. Mm-hmm. And I go down a rabbit hole on the EYRC website. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because we're kind of talking about, you know, the wellness aspect, the experiential and experimental nature mm-hmm. of design and architecture. And you've got these floating structures to accommodate sea change. And yeah. this kind of goes back to this idea of architect as futurist and your thoughts on that. And, you know, Matthew, with your background at Disney, I think it's the, I think Disney should have a, almost like a CEU that mm-hmm. architects mm-hmm. and designers could mm-hmm. go through, just the Imagineering process about yeah. how to sort of envision something different and to think differently about things, because thinking differently about problems are the only sure. way to accomplish solutions. You yeah. can't solve new problems with old solutions, you know? And so this idea of a floating structure to accommodate sea rise and mm-hmm. sea level change is really interesting to me. This idea of, and I remember years ago, a story, because I spent a lot of time in Texas, and the first school shooting that I remember was on the campus of the University of Texas in mm-hmm. Austin. Very qualified marksmen went up in the clock tower, and it was horrific. Mm-hmm. And that was the first one I remember, but that's not what we have these days. And I don't want to dwell on the idea of school shooting, but the idea that there are new challenges that architects are being faced with. Would you say, and Brent, I'll throw this out at you, would you say that the number of challenges that you're being faced with as an architect these days is more than previous? Has there been kind of like a comfortable lull through the 70s, 80s, 90s, where not a lot of changes were taking place that have to take place now? Because if you don't, there are negative ramifications.
Hmm. I certainly there's always been challenges. I think the few that you've brought up, the school shootings in particular, is obviously a newer challenge that we're just learning to kind of deal with and how to mitigate that. But in terms of other challenges, I think we've always had them. In terms of sustainability, obviously it's a hot topic, and it's a national, international narrative that we're not meeting the kind of goals that we need to turn the ship and right the path. I think the benefit we have these days is that we're able to have a dialogue with a lot more architects and participants involved in offering ideas. Whereas before, the strategies were really, or the challenges in the strategies were kind of resolved on a firm basis, or you might be a little bit more insular. I think the other part of it is that the challenges that were brought to, you know, that may have been raised in the past by the architect, you know, we have concerns about flooding. We may, you know, we're on a seashore here. These are the things we have to be worried about. Oftentimes our clients are now coming, are aware of those issues beforehand, and they come to us because they know that they need a creative solution. Mm-hmm. In the case of Varda Landing and our floating structures, that was a client that was born and grew up in this area, you know, sees a legacy of his family living in Marin for a long time. And he knew that in 100 years, you know, this compound that he was developing was going to be underwater. And so while there's many examples of communities around the world that have the infrastructure and support to live floating on water, you know, in California, we have a couple places here and there that people are floating, but in the future, in 100 years, if he's the only building in that neighborhood floating, what does that look like? You know, we're worried about his wellness and well-being if he's the only guy in a kayak and everyone else is underwater. So I think, yes, certainly it seems like there's a lot more challenges being discussed, but I think they've always been there. We're just up against a much more challenging timetable, I think, in terms of finding a solution.
Mm-hmm. Something else that you guys address, which is meaningful to me and many others, and it is close to my heart, but you guys address it in black and white as this idea of design justice. Mm-hmm. The reason I'm bringing it up is because I think it's incredibly unique. And I don't recall seeing anybody else really address this. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. We were talking about West Edge. In 2019, I ideated a panel for West Edge, basically about diversity in design and crafting our world the way it should be. And I had Ron Woodson, Bridget Coulter Cheadle, Brigham Jane, and Brian Pinkett on this panel. And that was recorded in September of 2019. George Floyd was murdered in 2020. Mm-hmm. Just serendipitously, this was published in June of 2020. And, you know, March of 2020 kind of threw my editorial calendar off. Mm-hmm. So things got backed up. But this went out in June, and I have never seen a response to any of the episodes that I've published before or since. It was huge. And it was interesting that so many people were starting to talk about it, but it's one thing to talk about it. It's another thing to put it in practice. This seems to be a core principle, a core value for the firm. How does the firm take something as an issue like that and apply practical application?
Mm-hmm. We're always looking for opportunities to do it in every project. And some of them have, you know, present more immediate and obvious opportunities than others. And some of them, like the Leimert Park Fridge project that you might have seen, where, you know, our, you know, internal design justice committee found an opportunity to build to help formalize an informal community fridge that had been set up outside of a shop in Leimert Park that had been, you know, in operation for, probably a year or more. And, you know, but was just kind of getting out of control. And so how to build this project that would sort of help organize it, let it be not just the fridge, but also dry goods, and give it just a sort of sense of intention and love. So that was, you know, pro bono thing that we were able to work with that, the actual shop owner to help design it with them. And then fabricate it ourselves and install it. And, you know, that was, you know, really a lovely example of that. But on other, you know, projects, like another one of the student housing projects we have underway at UC San Diego is for the Ridgewalk North Living and Learning Neighborhood. And that is going to be the new home of Thurgood Marshall College of UC San Diego. And that college, which was the third college that was founded there, and in the UC San Diego system, it's like, they're a bit like Harry Potter, in that you're, you know, Hufflepuff or Gryffindor or whatever. In that you can be studying any major you want, but this is just the house, if you will, that you sort of like live in as you're part of that college, right? So, but Thurgood Marshall was founded in the 60s, coming out of the civil rights movement, and really had this notion of social justice kind of at its core. It has a deep history of activism within the ranks of the students. And so, you know, so with that project and in cooperation with the university, we look at it very much as an opportunity for, for embedding social justice into the project. And so that's everything from the you know, the design and the massing into like the materials palette. You know, we've we heard from the users that they did not want this to feel like an anonymizing, slick, you know, corporate, if you will, like, you know, student housing building. So they wanted it to, you know, to reflect the colors of the earth and to reflect an architecture of the developing world, as they phrased it. And so, you know, how we were able to kind of respond to that. But what the net effect of that is, and this is coming from the leadership of that college that knows their students well and their students' value so well, is it helps create a sense of inclusivity. It's not like I have moved into this anonymous, gleaming white tower. I've now moved into something that is earthen and funky and unusual and patterned and layered, and there's room for me in it. I can show up here and be my own weird self, you know, my own unique self. And there's a place for me. So it's, you know, it's interesting to see, you know, and I think also within that project, we actually, you know, have a, you know, monthly meeting with the project team and the university, and we kind of go over, you know, how diversity, equity, inclusion is occurring within the project. And we kind of break that into like four categories. You know, one is, a diverse team. And so what can we be doing to make sure that there are diverse, you know, voices of all types, you know, of, gender and race and ethnicity and origin, like all these things that are making up the project teams. How do we spread the professional benefit of the project, the professional development benefit of having worked on something of this scale and type? And then how do we make sure we are sharing the economic benefit of the project as widely as we can with diverse and disadvantaged, you know, kind of communities? And so that some of that's on a subcontracting level, like, all right, well, how do you make sure that, the contracts are going to diverse and disadvantaged and veteran owned type buildings? But then also, like, how do you support local businesses that are, you know, maybe, you know, a restaurant or something? How can you help them get a catering contract with the project or that sort of thing? But it's interesting just to see it like focused upon with this much rigor by the team on a monthly basis of tracking all those kind of activities and offered opportunities and then cross-pollinating them with each other. It's really a very conscious effort to do it, but really rewarding when you kind of see all of those things dovetailing together.
Just to add on to that, yeah, I in terms of design justice and the firm, I think, like Matthew said, we were really kind of conscious of the pipeline and the designers and architects working on those projects. And so, you know, in 21 and 22, when all those events were unfolding and our staff were kind of bringing up these topics for discussion, I think we took a hard look at the pipeline of architects coming out of school and what we can do in our local school district and community to improve that pipeline. So we've done a lot more outreach, just simply, you know, informing students and youth what architects do. I think there's a lot of misconceptions about what skills you may need or what you may need to know or could be good at to be an architect. So I think that's
been anyone say I'm bad at math again as an excuse.
Yeah, exactly. I'm bad at drawing, I'm bad at math. It's no longer holding you back. You have tools right now that can supplement that. So yeah.
It's so funny that you say this about math, because like one of the reasons I do this, and I often say that if I had the skills to be an architect or a designer, I would do it in a heartbeat, but I don't possess the skills, and math has always been the first thing, but you still have to get through school. So I would say, that math is still important.
I think they dropped calculus at least as a requirement nowadays. I think that's gone.
Is that right?
As a prerequisite for architecture, I think it's gone. Yeah. I certainly didn't have to take it.
So, and it's funny too, because talking about the university architecture. Mm-hmm. And I, by the way, Matthew, I had to look it up. It was the University of Michigan, and it exists. It's a residential hall for graduate students. And I did not know that. I'm going to totally mm-hmm. look into that. So thank you for that. Yeah. But when we were touring schools for my kids, you know, going and looking at the architecture of Caltech, going and looking at the architecture of Arizona State, for example, amazing,
like mm-hmm. just, and some are more cohesive. Like most people have never been on the Caltech campus, but if you ever get a chance to walk that campus, mm-hmm. it's extraordinary. Yeah. It is just one of the coolest campuses. And then I'll just share this with you. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but when we moved to Tulsa, mm-hmm. have you ever heard about Oral Roberts University?
Yes, heard of.
Have you ever heard about the architecture of Oral Roberts University? Mm-hmm. Not just the big praying hands at the front, but the actual architecture of the university. When we're done, go look this up. Mm-hmm. It is wacky. It is bizarre. Mm. It is out of Logan's Run. It is just some of the craziest 1970s architecture that you will ever see. And when I drive by it quite often, and I just, one of the things that I love about that is, and as architects, do you get to be more creative on mm-hmm. university architecture? Do you get to take more chances? Do you get to try different things that you might not otherwise try?
Yes-ish. It depends on the institution and kind of what they're going for with the given project. There's some that are wanting you to swing for the fences with, you know, and there's others that want you to play in a very narrow, you know, window. So they're always looking for innovation, however, and how do you deliver like best value? You know, universities are always trying to be good, you know, well, maybe not the private ones, but the public, at least, you know, for certain, are trying to be, you know, good stewards of the public's money, and get best value that they, you know, well, the best value they can out of a project. And so, you know, but at, like the projects we did at Arizona State University, the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism there, you know, 235,000 square feet, you know, 5-6 story, you know, really amazing building. We did the School of Earth and Space Exploration at ASU there, you know, amazing 8-story lab building. And that, like with that one in particular, with the School of Earth and Space Exploration, like being able to incorporate this incredible program of clean rooms and laboratories and offices and everything else, but also this big public visitation component that, you know, the ground floor can, you know, serves as an exhibit with the 3D planetarium and all these other kind of components. Like, yeah, you're able to push it a fair bit there. And so, but I don't know, it's mixed. There's other times where you need to, you know, play it pretty straight and deliver very efficient things, but how do you bring a magic and an understanding of the campus and while you're having this very practical sort of efficient building happen, how do you bring a magic and a poetry to it at the same time? So that's always the challenge. I think that's very much part of our vibe.
Yeah. Bryn, any thoughts on that?
Oral Roberts, the campus architecture is quite impressive. Yeah. I'm sorry, I was getting lost in that. So yeah, I think like Matthew was saying, it's a little bit harder in that environment where they are trying to get the best value for their money. And I think there's been, it's in the smaller moments. It's in these little in-between spaces that we may be able to have more freedom to bring something special to a project. And I think there's many good examples of that at Theater District at UC San Diego and these pavilions or architectural follies in the landscape that to us are going to have hopefully the biggest impact on student life, you know, and bring something special. On the residential side, on the private sector side, you know, all again, clients are really looking for innovation right now. They want off the grid. And hopefully in an ideal world, you're able to kind of bring that innovation to the design in a way that formally, spatially, it's a little bit more exciting.
Listen.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead, please.
Oh, I was just gonna say it's kind of tricky. There's moments of architectural ambition in university and, you know, or school environments. You've got, you know, Diamond Ranch High School, you know, by early work by Morphosis out there. I just was touring that the other week. And you know, one of our employees, you know, their his mom is like one of the vice principal there and has been for many years. And while it's an architectural kind of adventure, it's arguable whether it's a successful place to educate kids. It's pretty cold and concrete and depressing. We recently completed the here in, you know, downtown Los Angeles, the Performing Arts High School there as part of LAUSD. Similar sort of thing, architecturally wild, you know, Coop Hemmelblau sort of project, that's really alienating for kids. You know, when we get back to wellness and a supportive environment, I think it's really important to keep in mind who is the client, who is the customer, mm-hmm. and it's, you know, and it's kids. and it's not that you want to necessarily put them up in a, you know, in a Disney environment, so take the other side of that, but you know, it's a bunch of fake chicanery and it's the Truman Show. But I think what you actually want is this place of authenticity, that really kind of like understands the place that they're in, the experiences they're looking to have, the growth that they're looking to sort of have, and how do you create spaces that actually generate the kind of, and you know, the real foundation of that. And I think the critical thing that our society needs now more than ever is community, and communion, and places to sort of come together and find the common ground, find the humanity, find the empathy in, you know, for each other. That we can be a cooperative species that is able to sort of move forward in harmony and not in chaos and conflict. So, so I don't know that, you know, so I think architecture has a really important role in that. Like, what is that built environment that the as people are growing and living are placed into? And I think this is where, you know, multicultural modernism, California modernism, the things that we sort of ascribe to are exactly that. It's like bringing people into together in the natural and supportive and beautiful kind of environment. So,
yeah, I totally agree. And this was a great opportunity. I love what you guys do, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk about it. Thank you for doing this.
Our pleasure.
Thank you, John.
Design Hardware's newly remodeled showroom is where you will find a gallery-style space with a thoughtful display of products, purposefully positioned to allow unbridled exploration and discovery. High-end faucets, luxury tile, natural stone, wood floors, and bespoke hardware selections are presented in a holistic manner, strategically arranged to stimulate creativity and transition your vision from the conceptual stage to a fully realized space. Conveniently located, free parking available, stop by to find your inspiration, collect samples, get expert advice, and tackle everything on your shopping list all in one place. Visit them online at designhardware.com or in the real world, 6053 West 3rd Street in Los Angeles.
Thank you, Matthew. Thank you, Bryn, for your time, talent, and willingness to share. I love these conversations. I love sharing them with you. Please continue to email me with your guest and show suggestions, convobydesign@outlook.com, and reach out to us via Instagram at convobydesign. Thank you to Convo by Design partners, sponsors, Thermosol, TimberTech, Pacific Sales, and Design Hardware. For more information about these amazing companies and links to these incredible brands, and to learn more about their products, please check the show notes. For more stories like these from the design community, please make sure you are subscribing to the podcast so you receive new episodes automatically the moment they're published. That way, you never miss an episode. Convo by Design is available everywhere you find your favorite podcasts, and I love sharing them with you. So thanks for listening. And until next week, be well. And take today first.